Welcome to The Approach Shot, the golf show that's more laughs than links, more stories than strokes, more guffaws than golfers. Here are the hosts of The Approach Shot, John Ashton and Neil Michaels.
And again, it is time for us to come into your lives. And we're jumping in with both feet. The Approach Shot. I'm John Ashton.
I'm Neil Michaels. And you forgot to tell me I needed to bring a bathing suit to jump into people's stuff because, you know, I don't want to do it fully clothed.
Well, of course not. You wouldn't want this.
Although I'm guessing they would want that.
The other people might.
That's right. I'm Neil Michaels. Welcome, welcome. How was your week?
Oh, you know, other than a few tornadoes, we're fine.
How is that the beginning of any sentence?
You live in this area of the country, it happens a lot.
There you go.
Now, it's great. And yesterday in the afternoon, we had some really bad storms in the morning, and then it got to be like up to 78 degrees with a lot of sunshine in the afternoon, which only caused the energy in the atmosphere to build back up again. So we had another series of very serious thunderstorms and tornadic activity in the evening.
Mm.
It is now the high temperature of the day. It's 48 degrees.
What?
That's what causes that stuff, is when a cold front meets a warm front.
Hello, and, I'm a cold front. Hello, yeah. I'm a warm front. Hello, I'm a tornado.
we're gonna fight it out.
You know, when I lived in Maryland, I remember them saying, and I'm sure they say the same in your neck of the woods, if you don't like the weather, don't worry, it'll change. And when you get to a point where it causes that, I want it to change again. I figured you were going to say when it got to be 78 degrees, you scrambled as quickly as you could to get your golf clubs.
No, because after having like 1.4 inches of rain in an hour.
Oh.
That's a little soggy.
It does get a little soggy, yeah.
Yes, it does. I thought since we were talking baseball today.
Yeah.
Well, I might do a little, I'll imitate you a little bit, do a little research and come up with some off the wall pieces of trivia that no one else in their right mind would know or care about, really.
I like the fact that at some point you assume I'm in my right mind, but okay.
Yeah, that's true. But I thought we'd play a little 6 degrees of separation with Major League Baseball.
Love it. Bring it on.
Okay. Let's start with Justin Verlander. Okay.
Yeah.
Played in the league with Julio Franco, right?
Yeah.
Julio Franco was intentionally walked once by Jim Cott, whatever, who allowed a pair of hits to Ted Williams.
Came into the league in the 60s, and Ted was still playing in the late 60s. Okay.
Yes, he was. Ted made his big league debut against Lou Gehrig.
Okay.
Lou Gehrig hit 4 home runs off of Walter Johnson.
Wow.
Walter Johnson once beamed Cy Young. Cy Young debuted in 1890, which was the final season played by Deacon White, the man who had the first hit ever in Major League Baseball history.
Wow. Look at you putting that ladder together.
How about that, huh?
So, wow, take that, Kevin Bacon.
That's right.
That's outstanding. Really terrific work.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That's outstanding. I love that.
Thank you, sir. Feel free to use it at any time.
You know, I was just talking with Dave Magadan, who we've had on the show. We were talking about people who had these really beautiful swings. They call them sweet swings. It looks like they're not putting any effort in, but they hit the ball really far. And we were talking about the fact that the people who are classified there, whose names come up pretty like right off the top of your head, Will Clark, Ken Griffey Jr., Ichiro, and Ted Williams were the guys who came to mind. And Ted Williams, at the point where Mags was still playing, he was the manager of the Washington Senators. So you could go up that pole that way too, to include his managerial style. It's fascinating talking to people about a sport that's been around for as long as you're talking about.
Yeah.
Because lots of things have changed and rules change and DHs and pitch clocks and making the bases bigger and all that kind of stuff. The game's the same.
I was once told, I cannot swear to the veracity of this, but I will repeat it, but under the caveat that it's a rumor I heard.
All right.
But the day that Fort Sumter was attacked in Charleston Harbor, the second in command was a gentleman named Major Abner Doubleday.
Oh, yes, this is true. I've heard this as well.
Yeah, and that the parade ground at Fort Sumter was the first place that baseball was really ever played.
This is great stuff, man. This is what makes the game great. And what's fantastic about it is it doesn't matter if you're a diehard or if you're just somebody who likes to go to a game just to experience the outdoors and the food and the beer and hot dogs and the cheering, or if you just have it on in your house while you're doing chores and things like that. I think most people who enjoy it, enjoy the history, enjoy the action. It's a great game, but what's interesting about it is that the more I play golf, the more I realize how much of a parallel it draws to baseball because of the speed, because of the necessary focus, because tweaking an arm this way or changing your grip that way changes everything, all of that stuff. It happens only in those two sports.
Yeah. And you were just talking about, you know, the Ichiros and the Ted Williamses and the Sweet Swing guys. I mean, we got the same thing. We got Ernie Els. We got Freddie Couples. I mean, it's the same thing.
Guys who totally just make effortless it look effortless.
Yep. Yeah. And the ball goes forever. But another little piece of non-baseball trivia related to Fort Sumter, which I think is hilarious, is the colonel, the guy in charge of the fort, the day it was attacked at 4:42 in the morning or whatever time it was, they knocked on the door and said, "The rebels are firing at us." He said, "Gentlemen, do not fight a war before 7 a.m. and went back to bed.
That's also why we don't record these podcasts before like 9. Great stuff. Well, I got to tell you, one of the people who has been so involved in baseball and whose voice you recognize, 1998, I think it was when we first heard his voice nationally, is going to be joining us today. One of the greatest baseball, football announcers of all time.
That's right.
Tom Brenneman's going to be joining us.
We will be right back with Tom Brenneman here on The Approach Shot. Do hang out with us. And we told you that we would be back with Tom Brenneman, and lo and behold, here we are, back with Tom Brenneman. Have we ever lied to you? We are The Approach Shot. I'm John Ashton.
I'm Neil Michaels, and I'm not going to lie. I'm geeking out. This dude is one of the greatest to ever do it, and so we're thrilled to have you. Tom Brenneman, welcome to The Approach Shot.
Thanks for having me, fellas, and thanks for the kind words. Hope you guys are having a good day.
How could we not? We've been talking to you.
Oh, yeah, well, I wish I had that for my wife every now and again.
And if you do, I'll give you my wife's number and we can really make this a thing.
Right. Good.
We're going to address the elephant in the room right to start with. If you have followed Tom's career, you know that there was an incident that he was fired for at Fox. I can tell you that we are not here to judge. We don't condone it. But by the same token, this is not what The Approach Shot is all about. So if that's what you're interested in today, go find it on the internet. Go dig it up in a tabloid someplace. We're here to talk about sports, about an amazing career, and about a guy who we listened to all our lives and thought, God, I wish we were him.
Yeah. And once we read in a book, too, let he who is without sin cast the first stone. So,
Well said, thanks. Sir.
Thank you, sir. Thank you very much.
Tom, you grew up in a household where you had some pretty big shoes to follow because your dad, how could you have done anything else with your life after what your dad did?
Well, it's funny. You know, I mean, I never really wanted to do it until I got to be about a sophomore in college. And then I'm looking around and I'm thinking, you know, I'm one of those guys. And I'm amazed by so many kids today who seem to know when they're 16 or 17 what it is they want to do for a living. I was not one of those kids. Wasn't a great student and, you know, more interested in having fun. And then it just hit me one day at the end of my freshman year. And I thought to myself, you know, I love sports. I love being around sports. I had a chance to do a little bit of it in high school. I played a couple of different sports in high school, but I broke my leg back-to-back winters. So I couldn't play basketball. So I got a chance back in the very early days before there was even cable on our little community thing to broadcast a couple of basketball games. I'm like, that was fun. And so I decided that, you know, I called my dad. I was driving down to North Carolina, where I lived with his parents every summer, and to work. I just said, you know, I'm thinking about getting into this. And he said, well, look, the guy who owns a radio station in Athens, Ohio, where I was going to college at Ohio University. He said, you know, let me call him and find out if they have anything going on around the station. It was a commercial station. I started off the air, you know, in a college town, you get a lot of people that are in and out all the time, trying to better their career and so forth. And so I got a chance the next year to be a DJ, next year to do a talk show, next year to broadcast some women's basketball games, and off it went. So, you know, for somebody who didn't want to do it, it certainly happened, thank God, very quickly.
Did you use Tom Brenneman on the air as a DJ, or did you come up with some wacky name?
No. It was Tom Brenneman.
It was.
I'm trying to impress all the girls. Come on. They'll remember my name.
Don't ask John Ashton or Neil Michaels if that's their real name either. So from there, you end up being the voice of the D-backs back in 98. And in 98, the D-backs were just sort of getting into their good swing. Is that right?
Well, you know, that was our first year, 98. I had left the Cubs 2 years early to broadcast the Diamondbacks games. And we had probably, I don't know, must have been 20, 25 people that were hired 2 years before the team started playing by Jerry Colangelo, who is the owner of the Phoenix Suns, legendary basketball Hall of Fame, general manager, head of USA Basketball. And he hired me. He was a Chicago guy, so he watched a lot of the Cubs games when they were a superstation back then on GM. So he hired me, and ironically enough, thank God, one of the other 25 people was a woman I'm married to now. 98's our expansion year. End of 98, they go out and they spend a gazillion dollars on a bunch of players. They had brought in Matt Williams. They had brought in Jay Bell. They bring in Luis Gonzalez and Steve Finley and Todd Stottlemyre, and the big one being Randy Johnson.
Right.
And all of a sudden, in the second year of the franchise, we get to the playoffs. Well, the third year, they didn't make the playoffs, and Buck Showalter got fired. My broadcast partner, Bob Brindley, took over as the manager of the team. We had, in recent year before, brought in Kurt Schilling, who was coming back from an arm injury. And those two guys, over the next 5 years, they were just unbelievable to watch. Never seen anything like it. And won a World Series in 01. So that was really a lot of fun. I mean, to be a part of something from the very ground up, much like I was with Fox when they started in 94. To be a part of something from the very, very beginning is just so unique and so exciting. And it very much was exciting out in Arizona for sure.
I can imagine. Being that you worked for a number of years alternating radio and TV with Harry Carey and the Cubs.
Yeah.
Except for like Kurt Gowdy, there's like no icon of baseball play-by-play you haven't worked with, is there?
You know, I've been really, really fortunate. I mean, to be around some of the people that I was around, and sadly, so many of them have passed. But my 6 years with Harry were just indescribable, both on the air. You know, when he was doing play-by-play on TV, I'd be doing radio. We'd flip-flop, and then we'd flip-flop again. But we'd have some sort of old NBC games of the week on Saturday where we'd only do radio. And so Harry and I'd get a chance to spend time together. But socially, we spent a lot of time together.
Oh, wow.
He sort of took me under his wing. I had just lost my grandfather. And when I first met Harry, and I shared that story with him, and I don't know if that was the sort of, you know, ignition behind the whole thing. But you know, before you know it, he and I were hanging out all the time, loved having a few beers and just listening to the guy. He was just such a larger than life character. Yeah. Great announcer. After he had the stroke, he wasn't the same. He'd be the first to tell you that. But man, oh, man, I just can't even put into words what those 6 years meant to be around him on a daily basis.
I lived in Boston in 67 when the Red Sox played the Cardinals in the World Series. And after the Cardinals won, the joke going around town was that most of us were so sad we were trying to commit Harry Carey.
Yeah.
Well, now, did you do the same with Johnny Bench? Did you take him under your wing? Because he hadn't had much announcing experience when you guys worked together. He also grew as an announcer. Was that something that you helped him with, or did he already have the chops?
No, he was much. It was really the other way, truth be told.
Really?
He had a chance by that point to do. He was doing the CBS radio game of the week. He had been doing the Reds games on television for 4 or 5 years, took the place of Joe Morgan when Joe left to go out to broadcast the Giants games. Johnny really helped me a lot. You know, Johnny could have been, in my opinion, and I've told him this, Johnny could have been, he could have been Tim McCarver before Tim McCarver. But it wasn't as important to Johnny Bench to be this big television star as a broadcaster as it was to Tim, another guy I had a chance to do a lot of games with, playoff games. If Johnny wanted to do it, like he wanted to be a great baseball player, he'd have been one of the great color analysts of all time. But he just had a lot of other things going on in his life that he enjoyed more, his family and playing golf. And but it was a fun 2 years having a chance to do those games with him. And I still talk to him on a regular basis now.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah.
So we have an interesting, we started the show by talking about six degrees of separation. And this is just one of those weird things. Last week on the show, we had Solomon Wilcots.
Yep.
Solomon had started his career at WLWT in Cincinnati.
Yep.
So did someone else.
Yep. Yep. Sure you just did.
You just don't get those kind of coincidences, you know, very often.
It's amazing how many guys, I don't know if it's in the water, I don't know what the deal is, but it's amazing how many guys that have really had outstanding broadcasting careers either still live here or have lived here or have some kind of connection here. When you look around the whole media landscape through the last 40, 50, I mean, Bob Trumpy was a great announcer for years and years. The golf, we still see him quite a bit here in town. Mm-hmm. But he was he had a great career. Joe Morgan, great career. Chris Collinsworth still lives here. Great career. Solomon Wilcots, great career. Kirk Herbstreit, great career. I mean, these guys go on and on and on and on. I don't know how to explain it, but there are so many of them that are from just with, if not Cincinnati precisely. And I think everybody has said, except for Chris, who lives across the river and now is actually for the first time moved to the Ohio side just in the last month or so. All of those guys are from around here. And you know, for Bench, for Solomon, for me, for Chris Collinsworth, he started at WLWT as well in Cincinnati.
Huh. Wow.
It must be something geographically, Tom, because I'm in Louisville. I came here in 1979 to work at Wacky Radio.
Yeah.
And then left for 10 years, then came back in 1991. And everybody I worked with in 81 when I left was still working in the market.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I had to go down to Elizabethtown and they said, what are you doing working here? And I said, waiting for someone in Louisville to die.
Right.
That's the only way you can get a
the same thing here. Yeah. The same thing on WLW Radio, one of the great radio stations in America. You know, forever, just until the last few years. I mean, they had the same guys. Three of them are still there. Two of them have since retired just in the last couple of years. But yeah, you know, I think Louisville and Cincinnati, and there are many others, but I just think that if you're raising a family in towns our size, roughly, Cincinnati's a little bigger than Louisville, but not a hell of a lot bigger. I think if you're raising families, you realize you get the best of so many things, but you don't get all the headaches of some other places. You know, we have incredible arts, one of the great, if you're into the arts, and one of the great cities in all of North America is Cincinnati. And we have it here, but it takes you, you know, instead of joining somewhere for $1,000, and it takes an hour and a half to get there and you pay $40 to park, you know, here it costs you $200, you park for $2 and it takes you 20 minutes to get there. Yeah. So there are a lot of very positive things about living in cities like this and raising your families in cities like this. It's not to say anywhere is perfect. It's not. There are good towns to live in and to stay in if you like living there.
Definitely.
Okay. There are two specific games or events that I want to ask you about because they were so important in baseball. One of them was personally important. One of them was not. The first being the Steve Bartman call.
Yeah.
I know what that did to that poor guy's life.
Yeah.
But it was one of those plays, one of those situations in a town that was ripe for something like that to happen.
Yeah.
Do you recall it as clearly as I think you do?
I remember it happened like it was 10 minutes ago, but probably for different reasons than some might think. They ultimately are all tied together. I remember when it happened and the ball goes down the line and Moise Salou's a Cub left fielder and he goes over by the wall. And after he, you know, jumps up, he doesn't get the ball and he, you know, slams his glove on the ground. And his reaction immediately was one is like, was he really going to get that ball? I'm still convinced to this day, there's no way on God's earth he's going to catch that ball. But, you know, people debate. It's fine. It doesn't make any difference. We'll never know. But as we're going along now, we're showing the replay and we're showing on and on and on and on Fox, the guy who caught it. And now we're going back to him in between pitches. Well, I can see off the air in a monitor, the guy who's got the camera down there on Steve Bartman. And I can now start to see off the air things starting to get thrown at him, whatever it was, wrappers or cups, ultimately beer getting dumped on the guy. And I'm hitting the talk back to our producer, Jeff Gowan, and our director, Jim Lynch. And I'm going, fellas, this is going to get bad. We can't keep showing this guy. And so we didn't for a little while. And then as they were getting him out of there, and you realize this was really getting bad, and they get him out of there and they get him out of the stadium. So everything happens. They give up the 8 runs in the 8th inning. They had 2 errors. Wasn't this guy's fault. I mean, all this guy did his whole life was love the Cubs. I got up the next morning. Game 7 was going to be that night. I'd gone to bed just feeling so terrible for the guy. And, of course, at that point in time, nobody knows his name. Nobody knows anything, right? So I get up the next morning in the hotel, and I turn on the TV, and the first thing I see is a helicopter shot looking down on some highway and building and everything. And I lived in Chicago for a long time. I thought it was just like a traffic report of some kind or maybe some kind of a news story. Well, it was a video, a helicopter flying over where Steve Bartman worked.
Oh, boy.
And I'm sitting there going, you have got to be kidding me. I'm like, this guy's name is out. And the Chicago Sun-Times, not the Tribune, the Sun-Times got his name, decided to put it in the paper. And this poor guy, I don't know how many days I've thought about him since then. It's an amazing story to think about the millions of dollars this guy could have made in a day and age where we live, where everybody's trying to cash in on some story they have or, you know, whatever. This guy's never done it one time, not one time. And that's in 2003. It's so long ago now. I think about him quite a bit, and I certainly hope and pray that he's doing all right. Cause man, that guy's life changed, as you said, forever.
Well, and you said it exactly. All he ever did was come out to a game and love the Cubs.
Yeah. Love the Cubs his whole life. Yep.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to ask you about the other one, but I think we're probably needing to take a break. Is that what you're telling me, John? Is that what the underhand wave is?
The heavy sigh meant we're going to come right back with Tom Brenneman right here on The Approach Shot. Hang out with us.
And we are right back. This is The Approach Shot. I'm John Ashton.
I'm Neil Michaels, and we're here with Tom Brenneman, just telling all kinds of stories. And I have to tell you this one, because John likes to talk about Louisville and you're talking about Cincinnati. I grew up in the Baltimore, Washington area, but moved to Atlanta right after the Olympics were there. And if you know anything about Atlanta, it's not a place that you can get around easily. It's not Cincinnati and it's not Louisville. It used to take us from the north side of town, downtown, to watch a baseball game, if it was a 7:05 start, an hour and a half to 2 hours to get there because traffic was such a mess. I had tickets to this game. It was a Tuesday night. It's already after work. It looks like it's going to rain. I had tickets in a skybox. So there's no excuse for me not going, because worst case scenario, I'm in a skybox having free food and beverages and talking to clients. But I decide, the hell with it. Tuesday, it's raining. They're playing the Diamondbacks. Who gives a damn? That, of course, was the day that Randy Johnson threw a perfect game.
Yeah.
And I've never let myself live that down, because it was overcast. It looked like it was just going to pour any second. Yeah. And yet there was not a second of delay in that game. And you called it.
I did. You know, it was one of those. I brought up Johnson and Schilling earlier. When Schilling came on board, Johnson signed in 1999 as a free agent, won the Cy Young. 2000, wins the Cy Young. 2001, the Diamondbacks win the World Series. Johnson wins it again. 2002, Schilling has something like 14 or 15 wins at the All-Star game. And the second half of that season, the Diamondbacks were the best team by far in the National League that year. They were going to win the World Series in back-to-back years. And then all of a sudden, the last week of the season, they had three starting position players that were knocked out with injuries within the final four games of the year before the playoffs began.
Wow.
I only say all that because for those four seasons, every single time Randy Johnson took the mound, every single game he started, you thought you had a chance to see a no-hitter.
Mm-hmm.
His stuff was just that good and that dominant. Yeah. I would suggest for anybody who watches baseball now and you're lucky to see a pitcher get through five innings in a game. I mean, Blake Snell wins a Cy Young Award last year. He averages like 5 2/3 innings, 5 1/3 innings to start. Go sure. back and just look at the game logs in 2000, 01, 02, 03 of Johnson and Schilling. From the very first start of the year, they're pitching into the eighth, the ninth. Never saw a game less than seven. And once every blue moon, there'd be a blow up, of course. But I mean, these guys were just unbelievable. And that night, Randy, you know, the team was down that year. Schilling was out for the year. The franchise was starting to go in a different direction with a bunch of younger players. For him to go out there that night was just fantastic because yeah. his career was already going to be in a Hall of Fame. Yeah. But that was just kind of like the cherry on top of the hot fudge sundae.
Yeah. Mm. And John, I'm shocked you haven't said this yet, but that was the Diamondbacks team that beat the Yankees in yeah. the World Series, John Bostonian.
Oh. Anybody who beat it, that's my favorite team. Red Sox and second favorite, anybody who's beating the Yankees.
Yes. Yeah, but it's funny. People have asked me, you know, many, many times through the years about, is there a favorite game you did or whatever it might be? And I always say that 2001 World Series, you were a month removed from 9/11, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so the season got delayed a little bit. For the first time, the World Series went into the month of November. But I remember, after the first two games, which Arizona won in Arizona, and they're up 2-0, the Yankees are going for their third straight World Series title. And when we go to New York for game three, we had an off day. Rudy Giuliani, the mayor of New York at the time, was looking for anybody and everybody who had any kind of name recognition whatsoever to come down to Ground Zero and just to spend some time with the people who were down there working. You had to see it to believe it. So our entire Diamondbacks traveling party flew all night after game two, and we went right to Ground Zero, straight from the plane. And, you know, Johnson, Schilling, Luis Gonzalez, whoever, Mark Grace, all these guys, Matt Williams, they're all talking to some of the workers down there, and you're just sitting there, and, you know, I was just watching and looking, and I'm just like, my Lord, this is just heartbreaking. The next night, game three, when George Bush came out, the president, to throw out the first pitch, and he throws this strike right down the middle of the plate, and this bald eagle is soaring around the stadium and lands, of course, on the trainer's arm. That moment, more than any other game, because the first pitch hadn't even been thrown yet, that 24-hour sequence of time or 36-hour sequence of time was just the most extraordinary thing that I've ever had a chance to be a part of.
Yeah, that is incredible. Watching it was emotional. Being yeah. there and participating like that must have taken a toll emotionally on most everybody.
You know, like so many things that can happen like that. When you watch it on television, it's one thing from 3,000 yeah. miles away and living out in Arizona. But then when you and even seeing the pictures of Ground Zero on television, which were on 24/7, to see mm-hmm. it in person.
Yeah.
Whew, yeah. yeah. Still gives me chill.
And then go play baseball.
Yeah, and the crowd was unbelievable. You know, the Yankees won in their final at bat the next three games, which was the first time it had ever happened in World Series history. So their fans got to see three wins, and then we went back out to Arizona. The Diamondbacks won the next two. So it was a hell of a World Series, though. I would argue one of the two or three best that's ever been played. Because, yeah. I mean, you talk about Hall of Famers now. There were 8 or 10 Hall of Fame players in that series. There were some heavyweights going at it in that series. It was good stuff.
Speaking of Hall of Famers, that is the way you describe your golf game. Is that not correct?
Well, it all of a sudden, that all depends on what Hall of Fame you're talking about. You know, it's funny, when I moved to Arizona, I was single. I was like 31 or something like that. And when I went out there, they had this thing for all the Diamondbacks employees that you go play free at this golf course all the time. So I'm single. I got my best buddy from college, who's a college baseball coach out there at the time. And so we would play all the time. And I was never any good, but I could get around. Yeah. But I used to hit it really well off the tee, and then my short game was terrible, like a lot of people. And then for whatever reason, you know, time starts going by. We had kids. I stopped playing. We moved to Cincinnati, and I'm like, okay, I'm going to start trying to play a little bit again. And now every time I hit the ball off the tee, I hit a ground ball to the shortstop, and my short game, I can stick any. I mean, it's like, where did all of this happen? I know I quit for a number of years. So my son turned out to be a pretty good player, and I'll go out with him every blue moon. But man, if I could get over the yips on the tee box, I think that I'd go back and start playing again. But I can't shake him. If you guys have any advice, please pass it along.
You know, that you still have any relationship with any of the sports psychologists for any of the teams?
I don't know where they are now.
The suggestions we have are probably not good for your health. That would be taking a shot first.
Yeah, drink more.
I might sign up for it anyway, because that means I could go out and play with my son and my dad, because they play together all the time.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
He might be too young for you to teach him to take a shot before the game, though, you know, on the 19th. Actually, one of the things that we've heard people say a lot is go to the range. And when you go to the range, don't just hit drivers. Don't just try to hit the ball as far as you can. Play on the range the same way you would play the game.
Okay.
And so at that point, you've got the game sort of already going by the time you get to the first one. But the yips are only going to – look, one of the greatest stories that we've heard doing this show is when Fred Lynn, who was a 6 handicap at the time, was playing at a best ball, and he was playing golf. I mean, a guy's a 6. He gets to the tee box, gets ready, has a bunch of people around him, is ready to go, hits the ball, hits the tee stanchion, and everybody looks up at the same time, and nobody can find the ball. Finally, the person who's responsible for doing it points behind him. He had actually hit the stanchion. It went above his head, and he was hitting 10 yards behind the tee without a tee.
Oh, my gosh.
If that happens to anybody, from then on, you can't have the yips. How could it get worse than that?
Oh, it can't get worse than that. No. But he has enough confidence where the next time he probably hammered one 270 down the middle or something.
With a 3-wood.
He's still hitting the ground ball to short.
There you go. What I love about hearing golf stories from people who have not mastered the game, because most of us haven't. No. And I play like you do. It's either going to be a ground ball to short, or maybe a line drive to center, or maybe a foul ball off to the right side.
Yep.
We'll know when we get there.
That's right.
Is that it's all fun and games. It's all great until you get the approach shots 6-pack. Then everything goes to hell in a handbasket.
Yeah, no doubt. I'm okay there, but it's getting there. It's a problem.
Well, we're getting there in just a few minutes. The 6-pack with Tom Brenneman is coming up right here on the approach shot. Hang out with us. And we have returned. We are the approach shot. I am John Ashton.
I'm Neil Michaels. And Tom Brenneman, look at him sitting up straight now. He's ready. He's in ready attack mode. 6-pack of questions. We will fire off 6 questions at you. Boom, boom, boom. We want the very first answer that comes to mind. Don't think about it. Don't hem and haw, because we got the ready for you if you do.
Okay.
All right, here we go.
Okay.
Question 1, you have visited virtually every major metropolitan city in the U.S., but you are a Cincinnati boy at heart, right? So compare Cincinnati's skyline chili to another credible food that made a city famous.
Well, they have pierogies in Pittsburgh, which nothing in Pittsburgh is anywhere close to being as good as it is in Cincinnati. So end of story right there. And move on. Next question.
Ouch. Okay. I noticed you didn't say anything about Philadelphia, so that was probably
smart. I love cheesesteaks, so I can't complain about cheesesteaks. Right. I love them and Skyline Chili.
And I got to tell you guys both the same thing. I just went to a Padres-Giants game a couple of days ago with my stepson, and he said, what kind of food do you want? And I said, a cheesesteak. I actually said, a steak and cheese. And he said, what's a steak and cheese? And I said, a sandwich? He goes, oh my God, I pictured you wanting like steak on one hand and cheese on the other hand. And I said, no, it's a cheesesteak. He goes, well, then why didn't you call it that?
Well, I'm surprised you could find meat in California. So go ahead.
There you go. Actually, he came back with a sandwich. And I was like, I'm not coming with you again. You're coming back with a turkey sandwich.
Right.
No, that doesn't count. No. All right. Question two. As a talent, you spent your entire career behind a microphone. If you had the opportunity to call one game with any announcer, living or dead, who would be your partner?
John Madden. On a Super Bowl.
Oh, nice. Mm. Yeah, you couldn't do much better than that, could you?
Yeah.
Mm. How about baseball?
A World Series game, and it would be with Bob Brenly. I was with him for so many years. He had a chance to broadcast a World Series with Joe Buck and Tim McCarver on Fox. I never made it above the number two team, but he's just so good. And just, we're close friends. I would love to have had that kind of World Series game with him before.
Knock wood that it still happens. Question three. You mentioned the worst part of your golf game is the tee shot.
Yeah.
So put on your best golf announcer hat and call your own tee shot.
Well, Brenneman up to the first tee. This is an area where he's really struggled through the latter half of his career. Let's see if that changes here. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. Oh, boy. That one's not even going to get to the ladies' tee. And I don't know if they play the same rules on the PGA Tour as they do, you know, about what happens when you don't make it to the ladies' tee.
But no.
Mr. Brenneman, not a good start.
I wish we could just stop there. Oh, brilliant. Okay. Question four. You called the Bartman play like we talked about. You called Randy Johnson's perfect game, BCS championships, MLB, NFL games. Is there one play, a specific play that stands out as the most exciting of your career?
Oh, no doubt about it. I mean, it was the very first BCS game on Fox. It was the greatest upset at the time in the history of college football. It's when Boise State beat Oklahoma in the Fiesta Bowl. Boise State had led the whole game, maybe about 2 or 3 minutes to go, maybe less than that. Oklahoma takes its first lead of the game. Boise State's facing, I think it was 4th and 27, and they do a hook and ladder play that goes for a touchdown. Mm. And the next play, they decide to go for two rather than tying. They go for two to win, and they do the Statue of Liberty play, and a guy runs it in the end zone, and they win the game. The most unbelievable fourth quarter sporting event that I have ever, forget call, that I've ever witnessed in my life. It was just, nobody gave that team a chance. Oklahoma's got number one draft picks littered all over the place. Adrian Peterson and Gerald McCoy. And I mean, it was stupid. And the starting center for Boise weighed about 250 pounds. And they won a game. And it was an unbelievable game. If you ever just want to watch something for fun, watch that last drive of the game by Boise State, because it's just, it's incredible.
The guts you have to call a hook and ladder followed by a Statue of Liberty is remarkable.
Yeah. Chris Peterson was a coach who later, of course, became the coach. He left Boise State, became the coach at Washington. And now I think he's on TV for Fox, if I'm not mistaken.
Fantastic. Wow. I do want to go back and look at that. All right. Question five. If I had to describe my golf game in one word, that one word would be?
Horseshit. You need any more? Is that two words?
No.
I think it's hyphenated.
No. Pardon my language. I'm sorry. Forgive me. Not good. That's two words. How's that?
No, I think we like the first one better.
Okay. All right.
And it's a lot more descriptive because of the smell that comes with it.
So. And boy, it does it ever.
All right. And question six, and we ask this of everybody who comes on this show. Since we are the Approach Shot Tom Brenneman, in your approach to life, what one rule do you live by?
You know, not to be so quick to judge other people. You know, you mentioned earlier, we weren't going to get into this and we're not going to get into it now. But I mean, you know, I went through a situation 4 years ago where I got fired for something I said I earned it. And so I'm the one who has to live with it and has lived with it every single day and the repercussions from it, including not getting another job since then for what I said. And I think that, you know, so many people were quick to judge me as being a homophobe. And by the word I use, you could certainly draw that conclusion. I'm not. And people who know me, men that are gay that know me, know that I'm not. But there's nothing I can do at this point to convince somebody otherwise. And you got to live with that. When I'm trying to apologize on the air for what I had said, it was live. Guy hits a home run for the Reds, Castellanos. It's turned into this meme that, you know, follows me now wherever I go. Sadly, it follows him wherever he goes, Castellanos. I spoke with him about this at length a couple of times on the telephone. And I just feel terrible for him. And so, you know, then people are making judgments about, you know, am I sincere in this apology? And, you know, all. So I think it's just, you know, don't be so quick to judge, because you mentioned earlier about he who casts the first stone. You know, there is no perfect person out there. And the last one that was perfect, the only one that was perfect, they had him nailed to a cross. Be careful sometimes to all of a sudden decide, okay, this is a horrible person, or this is a horrible, whatever it might be, before maybe we look in the mirror.
Amen. Yeah, I promised I wasn't going to get into it, but I am going to get into this one piece of it. You said what you said. You apologized for what you said.
Yeah.
You were sincere and honest about the apology. I think, frankly, this is a country of people getting second chances. I don't understand why that doesn't cross certain lines. The thing that people don't get, the one thing about this that really irks me on your behalf, John and I are announcers. We get it. You had just done something that you were horrified over and were trying to apologize for, but you're an announcer, a baseball announcer. There was action going on. So yeah. In the middle of this horrific event, the second piece of your brain, which is being a play-by-play announcer, kicks in and you call to play because that's what you were getting paid for.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you guys are the first people that have really ever pointed that out in an interview. And that's exactly what it was. I mean, you know, David Hill, who was the president of Fox Sports, used to pound away at us all the time. And he would say, nothing is more important than the next pitch because you're broadcasting for the people at home. And I just, for that moment in time, you're on live TV. You know what you've just done. You know what the possibilities could be, or your mind's racing on what they could be. And you know, you've hurt people most importantly. And then all of a sudden you just for a flashback there for a second, it comes back to the most important pitch is the next pitch. And you got to call a home run because the fans at home are watching because they want to know what's going on with the Reds. For people to think for a second, and I used to care, I really don't care much anymore. But from time to time, I'll read something where I'll just think to myself, you know, who's out there that can, for a second, even if you thought I was the worst human being in the world, how could somebody for a second make some kind of determination that my apology was insincere?
Yeah,
that's the only thing, you know. I mean, look, I wish I could go back and change the whole thing. I can't. My kids are the ones really that had to live with it a lot. My wife, of course, but you know, my kids were both these high school athletes at the time, and our son especially, so a really highly decorated lacrosse goalie on a very successful public high school team in Ohio. I mean, he'd hear it from the student body of other schools every time he took the field. You know, that's the stuff that hurts the worst. That's the stuff where it really hits home. Two or three of my biggest proponents now in terms of somebody giving me another chance to work are two gay men. Billy Beane at Major League Baseball, not Billy Beane, the general manager of Oakland, Billy Beane, the right-hand man of Rob Manfred, and Sid Ziegler, who owns the largest athletic gay website called OutSports in the world. And we've gotten to be very, very close friends over the last few years. That's nice to have those guys in your corner. You know, one of these days, if it works out, great. If it doesn't, you know, it doesn't. I mean, there are people in this world who feel sorry for him, feel bad for. I ain't one of them.
Very nice. Unless, of course, you want to feel sorry for his problems off the tee.
That's a whole different thing. Maybe you're on to something there.
We really can't help you with that. Hey, you're also doing some podcasts these days, yes?
Yeah, do a podcast. I was doing a daily show, sports talk show, on a streaming service on Chatterbox Sports. And now both on chatterboxsports.com, I do a show now just every Monday and every Friday. Every Friday, we try to do an interview show, kind of like you guys are doing, we're doing here today. Mm-hmm. And then Monday, sort of a... It's a cross between sort of local and national, a little more local toward Cincinnati sports and what's going on with the Bengals or the Reds or UC basketball, whatever it might be. But on our interview show, just because of the Rolodex, if for no other reason, we tend to get people who are more nationally known. And so it's been a lot of fun to do.
The talent that you've got cannot be sitting on the sidelines very long. Except again for your golf game, which sitting on the sideline may be the smartest place to be.
Precisely. Yes. Thank you. Thank you for reminding me.
As long as we're not on the sideline when he's trying to tee off.
That's exactly right.
Tom Brenneman, it's been a pleasure having you on the Approach Shot today. You did great on the six pack, by the way. I didn't see any sweat. I mean, you had the pose going. You're ready to go. But
ready to go. Thank you so much. I appreciate it, John, Neil. Thanks so much for having me, guys.
Great
I really
to meet you, Tom. Appreciate
my
it.
Pleasure. Thanks
for spending time with us here on the Approach Shot. Tom Brenneman has left the building.
That's going right off of my bucket list.
I mean, he sounds so much like his dad. It's confusing.
Yeah. And yet, just his conversational voice, he talks like that. You know how many, when we hear announcers and they're like, "Hey, I'm John Ashton from Louisville, Kentucky." And it's like, you know, they don't talk like that at home. "Hey, honey, what are we going to have for dinner tonight? Where are we going for dinner?" Nobody does that.
The good guys on the radio don't do that either. I hate it when somebody goes, "Hey, talk in your radio voice."
Do your radio voice.
Sorry, this is my radio voice.
Right. You sound so much better there. Impression.
That's it. It's all electronics.
That's right. Yeah, we don't talk like that. My daughter was a singer, and people would say to her all the time, "Can you sing something?" It's like, would I say to you as an accountant,
"Add up something"?
Exactly. "Hey, grab your calculator. I got some things for you to add." Anyway, we got an interesting email this week on approachshot.net.
Okay.
There is a page there that says "Talk to us," and we had a couple people who did. Jeff from Bethesda, Maryland, sent in an email that I thought was really appropriate. He said, "Hey, are you guys going to the Masters?" And I wrote back, "No, we're just a golf-flavored podcast. John might be going, but no." our buddy Frank Bassett from Golf Talk America going and is going to be broadcasting his shows from there, you son of a bitch.
My co-host on Those Weekend Golf Guys will be there also.
Okay, so both of the guys we know well who didn't invite us are going. Yeah. Isn't that great?
It got
me to thinking about the fact that you are thinking about going to the U.S. Open.
PGA Championship.
I'm interested in this because you and I have talked so much about the times that you've gone to the Kentucky Derby, golf championships. Are you a guy who, when you go to those events, get your spot and that's it? I'm camped out.
No.
You wander?
I wander. Well, as a Derby, I don't wander because you get, lost in the crowd.
Mm-hmm.
Especially if you can find a place where you can see a horse, it's best to stay there.
Yeah, stay there. Right. And when you go to a golf tournament, are you looking for a particular view, like a hole, or do you follow
usually follow a specific group. In 1988, I was at the, at the time it was the Bell South Classic in Atlanta.
Uh-huh.
And my brother-in-law and I both lived in Atlanta. We went to it and we followed a group of the twosome of Ray Floyd and Fuzzy Zeller.
Oh my gosh. That had to be fun. Those funniest
two guys in the world. They were doing routines all 18 holes. These guys are just so good. Fuzzy was walking up. His caddy was already at his ball. It was after his tee shot. He was about to make his approach shot.
Nice.
And he walked up the fairway smoking a cigarette. And he just gets up to the caddy, throws down the cigarette on the fairway, looks at the caddy, goes, "What do we got?" The caddy said, "172," and handed him a club. He took one practice swing, addressed the ball, put it on the green, bent down, picked up the cigarette, and walked off.
That's how the game is played. Maybe that's a bit of advice we should have given. Just don't care. Just make it seem like you don't care. That's fantastic.
Don't think about it. Yeah, but it was great, and those guys were just hilarious. I don't see how they could keep straight faces or play golf laughing that hard.
Well, maybe that's a key that nobody taught us, is maybe if you're relaxed and you're really not overthinking, mm-hmm. maybe at that point you play better.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys talk about that all the time. Don't overthink. Don't tell yourself what not to do.
Don't have numerous swimming thoughts in your head.
You just don't have time to be able to address those things. Just go up there and have fun.
Yeah. You know, and if you have to pay royalties to Nike, just do it.
Exactly. Or if you have to pay, you know, somebody's hospital bill because you clunked them with the ball, that's a whole different thing.
Little piece of advice, even though the signs say that golfers are responsible for damage, I have heard from an attorney friend of mine.
Attorney friend, okay.
That should you damage a home on a golf course, you are not liable.
Hmm.
It is something that it is a risk they assume by buying a house on a golf course.
Oh.
So no matter what sign threatens you, don't worry. The thought of don't hit that house will basically make your brain do to your body what is necessary for you to hit that house.
Right.
That's what saying don't does on a golf course. So
I usually, when I'm playing and I'm playing near a house that backs up, I take out, it doesn't matter what ball I played up until then. I use a TaylorMade because I figure if I hit the house and it makes an impression, it'll say Taylor. And so they won't be looking for somebody named Neil. Oh, well, okay. Thank you, Jeff from Bethesda, for the email. And guys, feel free to go to approachshot.net, talk to us page, and send us some comments, some thoughts, what you thought of the show, who you'd like us to have on, what you think of our silly stories, anything you'd like. It's approachshot.net. Go to the talk to us page. Well, another fantastic interview in the books.
But you can hear us anytime you go to approachshot.net. Also go wherever podcasts are available, or believe.com.
That's
right.
Just
listen to us there.
And we will be back again next week with another fantastic guest. But until then, I'm Neil Michaels.
And I'm John Ashton. And we are The Approach Shot.
You've been listening to The Approach Shot with the Weekend Golf Guys. If you like this week's episode, be sure to subscribe to the podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you download your podcasts. And find us on the web at approachshot.net.